This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
In the Jodcast studio, we have our very own Tim O'Brien, and he will answer some of your burning questions. So one question is from Nick Johnson, and he says, I have understood that black holes grow relative to the amount of material that they consume. If, though, all the material going into a black hole is compressed to a singularity, what process is making the black hole increase in size?
Okay, well, it's a good question. I mean, he's right, of course, that black holes do grow when they consume material. And he might be right, of course, that maybe the material's all compressed into a singularity. The trouble is we can't see inside a black hole, so we're not sure what happens to stuff when it disappears inside the black hole. We don't know of any force that would stop it all being compressed into a singularity, so maybe we'll assume that's the case, but we don't really like infinities in physics, so maybe something else happens. But anyway, to answer his question, the crucial thing is that what determines the size of a black hole, when we talk about the size of a black hole, there's two things really there that are often confused, and one would be the mass of a black hole, and one would be its sort of physical size, its diameter, if you were to measure it. Now, it's sort of easy to understand what we mean by mass. You add more mass to it, add another 10 kilograms, it's 10 kilograms more in mass. It's relatively straightforward. But the size is a different thing. The way we define the size of a black hole is by the point at which nothing can escape from the black hole. So if you imagine getting closer and closer to a black hole, the force of gravity increases and increases as you get closer to it, to the point at which the speed at which you'd have to travel in order to escape the gravity of the black hole becomes greater than the speed of light. At that point, where that escape velocity is equal to the speed of light, we call that point the event horizon. And the distance between, if it was a spherical black hole, if this was all nice and symmetrical, we'd have a sphere. The radius of that sphere out to the event horizon, from the singularity to the event horizon, is called the Schwarzschild radius. So in fact, relatively simple physics lets us calculate the radius, the Schwarzschild radius. It turns out to be equal to 2 times G M over C squared. So G is the gravitational constant. So
it's capital G.
Capital G, that's right. M is the mass of the black hole, and C is the speed of light. So 2gm over C squared. So if you go look up the value for the gravitational constant, you can substitute in some numbers, and having done that already, I can sort of tell you what would happen. For example, if we could take the Earth and we could squash it down in size, the force of gravity at the surface of the Earth would increase. You know, if we can imagine the Earth shrinking, we'd be closer to the center of the Earth, so the force of gravity would be greater. If we could keep squeezing the Earth down and down and down, if we got it down to a radius of about 1 centimeter, just a little less than 1 centimeter, then it would be a black hole.
Right.
So the event horizon, the Schwarzschild radius for an Earth mass object, is about 1 centimeter. For the Sun, it's about 3 kilometers, so you'd have to squeeze the Sun down to about a radius of about 3 kilometers. And you can go up in mass, and you can think, okay, well, these are quite small things, really, so, you know, how big can we get? Well, one of the biggest sorts of black holes that we think we know about are the centers of galaxies. Typically, we think there may be range between about 1 million and 100 million times the mass of the Sun. And so there you're talking about Schwarzschild radii of something like 1 million to 100 million kilometers.
Right.
Now, in fact, you know, it sounds a lot, but then if you think about it on the scale of the solar system, the distance between the Earth and the Sun is about 150 million kilometers. So in fact, the size of the black hole in terms of its event horizon, these giant black holes, these supermassive black holes that cause the galaxies, is actually slightly smaller than the size of the Earth's orbit around the Sun, or are of the same order.
Okay. So it's the escape, when the escape velocity is the speed of light, determines the size, the event horizon of a black hole, basically.
That's right. So basically, yeah, they are increasing in size as they increase in mass, and it's the event horizon that's working its way out.
So John Edge found something very interesting in the BBC series Robin Hood, on the episode called Total Eclipse. So he noticed that a few minutes after the eclipse occurs, Robin is standing on the castle walls talking about freedom, etc. And behind him is the blue sky and a moon, clearly roughly at half moon. Now, that doesn't sound very consistent with having a total eclipse just a few minutes before, does it?
No, that's right. I mean, it's a good example of bad astronomy. There's lots of them out there. And of course, the point is that if there's a total eclipse, the moon passes in front of the sun. The moon's, about the same angular diameter as the sun in the sky, so they both are about half a degree across, coincidentally. So if the moon happens to pass in front of the sun, then it more or less exactly blocks it out, and you get this, you know, wonderful thing, a total eclipse. But of course, you know, it's very slowly moving across the face of the sun, you know, so a few minutes after, or half an hour after, or whatever, in this particular Robin Hood episode, then yeah, the moon would still be very close to the sun in the sky. It would be what we call a new moon, so almost invisible, really, because it's basically lit from the back. The sun's much farther away, it lights it from the other side, but it's still very close to the sun on the sky, so there's no way you'd have seen a half moon. It would have been something like half the lunar cycle later, before it's on the other side of the sky, so that would make it a full moon. So he said he saw a half moon, so that would have happened about a week after the eclipse, not half an hour after the eclipse.
Well spotted, John, thank you very much. And Andrea Ashworth is wondering about the difference between dark matter and dark energy. What is exactly the difference? And she's suggesting, is it perhaps the same thing?
Well, no, definitely not the same thing. So, where the confusion arises, it's simply because we have to think of a name for these things that we don't understand. And perhaps if we do it in historical terms, we came up with the term dark matter before we came up with the term dark energy. So let's look at dark matter first. One of the best pieces of evidence for dark matter was that when people were measuring the motion of stars or gas clouds as they orbit a galaxy, So our galaxy, for example, is spinning, and the disk of the Milky Way is spinning. It takes us about 200 million years or so for the sun to go all the way around the Milky Way. And we can measure the speeds at which things are moving around the galaxy. And basically that speed is determined by the mass of the galaxy. So just like the speed of the Earth's orbit around the sun, or say the moons of Jupiter around Jupiter, those speeds are determined by the mass of the object that they are circling, that they are orbiting.
Those are the laws of Kepler, right?
That's Kepler's laws, indeed. It's been known about for many, many years. So people were trying to measure the mass of galaxies by measuring the speeds at which these gas clouds were orbiting them. And it was actually realized that as you went to gas clouds that were farther and farther and farther away from the middle of the galaxy, what should happen, according to Kepler's laws, would be that the speed at which the gas cloud was orbiting would drop off, because the force of gravity was getting weaker. And in fact, it turned out when these measurements were made that in many cases it didn't drop off at all. It stayed roughly constant. Even when the gas cloud was way beyond most of the visible mass of the galaxy. So it really should have been slowing down by then, and it just wasn't. So what it was, the implication was that there was lots of material with mass extending well out beyond the visible mass of the galaxy that was increasing the gravitational pull and causing these galaxies to be circling faster than we would have otherwise expected. So it was matter that was dark. It was not producing any radiation at any wavelength that we can see.
Otherwise we would have seen it already.
We'd have seen it. It would have been visible light, or it would have been radio waves, or it would have been X-rays or whatever. We just couldn't. It was literally invisible. There was no radiation coming off it, but it had mass, because it had gravity, and we were seeing its effect through gravity. So it's dubbed dark matter, known about for a long time now. We still don't know what it is, and we still believe it's out there. Best guess is that it's some sort of subatomic particle that remains to be discovered. Now, dark energy is a more recent phenomenon. So in fact, this was this name arose about 10 years ago now. When a rather startling observation was made, ever since we first discovered that the universe was expanding. So back in the 1920s, Hubble and collaborators measured the speeds at which distant galaxies were moving away from the Milky Way. In fact, they were all moving away if you went far enough out in the universe. And they realized that meant the universe was expanding. Ever since then, we'd assumed, or one of the big questions in cosmology was, can we weigh all the galaxies that there are? Can we measure their mass to determine how much mass there is in the universe, to work out if the force of gravity between the galaxies would be sufficient to overcome that expansion, such that at some distant point in the future, maybe that expansion would even stop and perhaps lead to a re-collapse, and maybe a big crunch at some point in the future following the Big Bang. So basically we knew that the universe must be slowing down in its expansion. The gravity was bound to be pulling the universe back together, and so this expansion must have been gradually slowing down. The real question was it slowing down enough to cause a collapse or not? The really startling thing that was discovered in 1998 with observations of distant supernovae was that it appears that the universe isn't slowing down in its expansion at all, it's accelerating. And that was like, you know, it's mad, you know, it's mad physics. It's sort of, you know, shouldn't have been happening. Clearly gravity should have been pulling these things back together, but in fact they were shooting apart. And it's like anti-gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we couldn't call it anti-gravity, that would sound unscientific, so we had to have a new name, and I guess the fact that we had a name called dark matter just led to the name dark energy.
Right.
So it was some form of unknown energy in the universe, maybe we still don't know what it is, something that causes this sort of the universe space to expand even faster and faster and faster. So they're different things. The linking thing is we don't know what they are. So in fact it turns out, you know, recent observations of the cosmic microwave background, for example, show us that something like the normal matter, the stuff that we understand, you know, the protons, the electrons, the things that we're made of that you can, you know, bang this table and you feel, that sort of stuff makes up probably only about 4% of the mass energy content, mass and energy being equivalent according to Einstein. Dark matter makes up something like, I don't know, 20-odd percent of that, of the universe, and dark energy, the remainder, maybe 70% or so of the day. So in fact, we only understand about 4% of the universe at all.
And the rest we can't see.
And the rest we can't see, and we can surmise, you know, we can see that there's something there, and I think, you know, it sounds like we're going backwards, but in fact it's not true. We're always making progress. But it's often the case that when you answer one question, you open up several more questions to be answered, and this is an example of it.
Yeah, so would you think that dark energy and dark matter, as Andrea puts it here, are just two phenomena used as an excuse for inadequate and inaccurate physics?
I think that's a bit harsh. I think what we've done is we've made observations. We compare them to the current level of our understanding of physics. And we see where there are discrepancies, and clearly there's a discrepancy, you know, in the sense that in the case of dark matter, the behavior of these orbiting clouds of gas is different than you'd expect for simple Keplerian motion if you could see all the mass that was there. So the simple solution is that there's some mass there that you can't see. Now, a radical solution is that actually our understanding of gravity, as expressed in Kepler's laws, is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to change our physics. And maybe that will turn out to be the case. And it's certainly a possibility that people explore and is seriously considered. So you try to keep an open mind. And if there's new physics needed, then I'm sure it'll arise.
Okay. Well, that's very clear. Thank you very much for answering those questions, Tim.
No problem.